Blog Talk Radio.
Internet world, welcome to the Cross in the Desert, speaking hope and freedom to Iran. I'm your host, Randy L. Noble, and thank you once again, everyone, for taking time out of your busy schedule to meet with me today on my broadcast. It is a beautiful summer-like day here in Florissant, the day off of work, and just the right time to meet with you today. I have lots to discuss today on the program, and we're going to begin with the presidential election just hours away from taking place in Iran. I really need to watch my words, though. This is not an election. It's a farce. And I've talked about this many times on my program. I've documented it. Iran loves to give the impression and the image to the world that this is some kind of free democratic election, and it's the farthest thing in the world from a true election. This is not of the people, by the people, for the people. The Guardian Council has to select a candidate. They have to be sworn allegiance to the supreme leader, to Islam. This really is not a democratic process. And the thing that is so sad is that many, many thousands of Iranians who are opposed to the government in Iran will reluctantly go to the polls, because in many cases, they're monitored. If they don't vote, they can lose their benefits and maybe even something worse. But the thing that is so sad about this is that when you cast a vote for any of these candidates, you're really empowering this regime. You're really legitimizing this regime. And the best thing Iranians can do is to boycott the election. But unfortunately, some of them will still reluctantly go to the polls. And so today what I want to do, I want to feature an article about this election that is eye-opening. And it was written by my dear mother, I call her affectionately, Sholeh Pakravan, who is the mother of Rahane Jabari, who of course was executed almost 3 years ago in Tehran for defending herself against a government rape attack. She has a way with words, and I when I first read this article, I said, Sholeh, you are the most courageous lady in the world. She is not afraid to stand up to this regime. And this article, well, the best thing I can do is read it to you. I want you to hear from someone who refuses to do anything to legitimize this regime. And she has a way with words, unafraid to stand up to the regime that killed her daughter almost 3 years ago. She calls them the murderers of her daughter. Rouhani was only 26. She was 10 days away from her 27th birthday after spending 7 years in prison being tortured and interrogated. In October 25th, 2014, this unholy regime executed her. And, of course, you can read all about this in my book, Rouhani, A Beautiful Fragrance. But I want you to hear Sholeh Pakravan as she speaks out against this upcoming election just a few hours away in Tehran. Sholeh writes, I will not vote for any of the six players, neither the three main players who shamelessly revealed the theft and crimes of the others in front of everyone else's eyes, nor will I vote for the other three extras who have joined in to warm up the show, as she says. All of these players have one thing in common. All of them support imprisonment, torture, and execution. And the main demand of the people of Iran is also clear. They demand freedom, which is not achievable under the shadow of any of these candidates. People want to know why their young children were killed. Where are they buried? Why and how the people's treasury was robbed? When public opinion is enlightened, then there might be the need for a much greater election, not to choose between bad, worse, and worse. Who has said that the people of Iran must choose between a thief, a murderer of youths, a charlatan, and an executioner, and elect him for the office? And, of course, she's referring to Rouhani. I would never vote for someone who was a member of the Death Commission. I would not vote for someone who takes pride in setting up gallows and appointing a murderer as prime minister. I would neither vote for someone who is an expert in two-pronged offensive and his hand is in the pocket of people. To participate in the election of one of these people is complicity in the destruction they have increasingly imposed on our people. Is staining our hands with the blood of those who have killed and will kill in the future. If we vote for them, it is closing our eyes on the suffering of the survivors of execution victims and ignoring the tears of families whose loved ones have been imprisoned on the charge of being innocent. Some claim that if they do not choose the bad, then the worse will take office. But what are they afraid of? Was it any different for us when the bad ones and the worst one took office in previous years? Did it ever change the number of executions and the extent of poverty? It would continue to be the same this time around. How are we going to vote and forget the eyes of Gohar Eshagi, mother of the slain web blogger, and labor activist Sitar Beshadi, who was tortured to death in 2012? How could we not remember the last gaze of Neda Aga Sultan? How can we forget the voice of Arash Satterjee and the voice of Sharam Ahmadi? How are we going to forget the beheaded childhood of Ryan and Rawada and other children whose fathers have been executed? How can we forget the children who stay with their mothers in the cold cells in prison? How can we forget the damaged faces of girls whom were splashed with acid and the mourning of a mother who reads the news of her child's execution in the newspaper and the pain and the suffering of the prisoners and their families? I will never forget the depressed youths who have no hopes for future and the ashamed fathers who are not able to feed their families, nor will I forget the poor people who have to sleep in the graves because they have no homes. We would better forget to forget and every moment remember the destitution imposed on our homeland. If we do so, could we think of voting in these elections? Let them stage their show and celebrate their victory on their own. One day, not in a distant future, they will be put on trial and brought to justice more disgraceful than ever. This is the promise of history. History has seen many criminals and thieves in various robes who have ruled over our people's lives and properties. But today, what remains from them is just a detestable name. I will not vote for the murderers of thousands of youths. I will not vote for the thieves who plunder my country. I will not vote for those who took the innocent to the altar. I will not vote for the murderers of my Rahane and many more like Rahane. My dear mum, as I affectionately call her, Shelley Pakravan has spoken, and what a voice she has. I intend to make her voice be heard all over this internet. There was a video and an audio file of this. Thank you so much, NCR, for publishing this explosively powerful rebuke to anyone who would want to vote and legitimize these murderers. Shelley says something very eye-opening to me. She says, one day, not in a distant future, they will be put on trial and brought to justice. This is the promise of history. Shelley, you are absolutely right. God has a timetable. And when his cup of wrath is overflowing, he will intervene. He has raised up kingdoms and brought them down. Just recently, he called to account Fidel Castro in Cuba. This regime will fall. And you are right, Shelley. It is the promise of the sovereign God of history who was watching over the suffering of your people in Iran, and he has not turned a deaf ear to their cries. He will intervene. And you're right, Shelley. This is the promise of history. You can read this powerful letter right up on my Facebook. There's a lot of things on my timeline. Just scroll down and you will find your way to Shelley's very, very powerful letter. Enough said. I want to turn our attention right now to a very brand new friend of mine on Facebook. Her name is Jacqueline Sultan. She is a human rights attorney living in Pakistan, and her life is in danger because she is standing up against forced conversions of young Christian girls, which would include forced marriages to Islam. And she is in danger. She has been threatened. She has been summoned by letters and emails. One of the letters delivered to her office said, "Your end shall be like Asiya Bibi, Shabnaz Bahati, and Salman Taslim. We also instructed you before, but you did not desist from doing such acts. Now you will not desist, then you should prepare to die." I want to read to you Jacqueline's story. It's on my Facebook page, Praying for the Persecuted Church and Beyond the Veil. She is a Christian lawyer raising voice against forced conversions, and she has received death threats. She has been advocating for rights of minorities and raising voice against forced conversions of girls hailing from minority communities. She has been warned not to continue to do this. She is a high court advocate as well as a member of the Karachi Bar Council. After she received the threatening letter, Jacqueline informed the incident to Naeem Karish, president of Karachi Bar Association. The incident was also reported to other agencies. This letter that I read to you was found in her chamber. Now, the Karachi Bar Association has urged the authorities to take serious action regarding the matter and provide Jacqueline with foolproof security. They also urged the authorities for an inquiry into the matter as to determine who these people are. The lawyer's body demanded for immediate action and arrested the people who have threatened her. And of course, this letter and this story has been raised to many human rights activists and political activists. And so I'm using this as an opportunity to speak out for Jacqueline and her security and safety, and also to ask that you would please pray for this beautiful Christian lawyer who is doing what she can for religious freedom in Pakistan. She's standing up against forced conversions, and she is putting her life on the line. And I want you to please go to my Facebook. Her story's right up there. You can comment and say whatever you would like to say. But most importantly, please pray for Jacqueline. She needs our urgent prayers at a very difficult time in her life. You know, I wrote a book almost 2 years ago called Prisoner of Her Culture, Sakina's Fight for Freedom. It's all about Pakistan. And it's a story of a young Muslim girl who becomes a human rights activist. And it's a very powerful book, and I sent it to Jacqueline just to let her know that I'm speaking out for her country and for the needs of her people there. But please remember in your time this morning, in your time this afternoon, to please pray for Jacqueline, that God would protect her, deliver her, and that these people who are responsible for these death threats would be apprehended and arrested. Well, speaking of persecution and death threats, I really am excited about a new documentary film about to hit the theaters right on May 23rd. It's called Faith Keepers. And what it is, it's a documentary film standing up for the atrocities committed against Christians in the Middle East, in Iraq, and places like that, and the genocide that is going on right in front of our eyes. We see it every day on the internet. What I'd like to do right now is first I'm going to play for you a trailer. There are a couple of seconds in this trailer where the participants are speaking in their own language. But listen carefully to this trailer. It'll give you an idea what Faith Keepers is all about. Let's listen.
The current status of Christians and other non-Muslim minorities throughout the Middle East is the worst it's been in centuries.
21 people were killed when a powerful bomb exploded in front of a Coptic Christian church.
Muslim mobs began attacking Christian churches.
They are targeting churches, temples, cultural and historical sites.
يعني بغضوني بالقوة واختصموني وتقريبا أربعة أيام خمسة أيام رجعت للبيت هو كان بسيارة راجع من شغلة لزموا إيده ورجله ورايده ويقطعوا راسه.
I converted from Islam to Christianity. I was arrested, and after that they gave me a death penalty. What I told the judge in this day, if loving and worshiping Christ is a crime, I'm guilty as charged.
The Christians of Iraq and Syria who fled ISIS narrowly escaped a genocidal campaign of mass murder, of crucifixion, and of beheadings.
Now we are here in our center for you. We have here 186 caravans, 260 families here.
What is taking place in the Middle East, particularly in Iraq, is genocide.
They call this ethnic cleansing. This is the real word.
The administration's failing, the Congress is failing, and quite frankly, with all due respect, the church is failing.
In response to persecution, I always want to tell people to pray. Stop, pray. Be burdened for your brother and sister, but get involved in the fight and help.
And doesn't matter how small is your voice, you can make a difference, even if you are just one person.
I can't wait to see this film. Now, the producer of Faith Keepers is Paula Queskin. You might remember her name. She was the producer of the very, very powerful documentary, Honor Diaries, which came out about 2 or 3 years ago. And I've featured many, many stories on this broadcast about Honor Diaries. Of course, Honor Diaries talks about female genital mutilation and other crimes committed by Muslims against women all over the world. And it featured actually many Muslims who are human rights activist speaking out against these atrocities. It was a very, very powerful human rights film. And equally as well, Faith Keepers is now specifically talking about Christians being persecuted by ISIS, being beheaded, genocide being committed against them. I want you to hear, it's just a couple of minutes long, but I want you to hear some powerful words from the producer of Faith Keepers. Let's listen to Paula Queskin.
We're witnessing a genocide. We're witnessing a refugee crisis not seen since World War II. We're talking about child sexual trafficking, the rape and sale of children on a stunning scale. Many who manage to escape cannot escape their trauma. Too many have taken their own lives rather than live with the memories of what they went through. The persecution that we're seeing today, it's nothing new. But the difference is that we have the internet and social media. We're watching genocide in real time. When something happens on the other side of the world, we know about it immediately. And that knowledge brings with it responsibility. The current status of Christian and other non-Muslim minorities in the Middle East is the worst it's been in centuries. The persecution we're seeing today is part of a bigger picture. This is the continuation of a long history of persecution. The continuation of an ideology of hatred, which has permeated this entire region for centuries. Christians and other minorities in the Middle East are facing extremism and cultural annihilation. If we don't do something about it now, it will be too late. But when you visit the refugee and IDP camps, among the young people, there's still incredible resilience and hope. This might seem way too big for any individual, but the reality is that for Christians on the ground, the mothers, the fathers, the children, even the tiniest act of love can make a huge difference.
That is Paula Queskin. She is the producer of the movie Faith Keepers. And the best way that we can support and get the message out is, first of all, go see this film. Second, host a screening in your community. Just like Honor Diaries, you can pay for the rights of having this video shown to a large audience, to a small, to a comfortable-sized audience. But the whole purpose is education, awareness. Now, there are many different charities that you can give to in the help of getting food and shelter to many of these displaced Christians all over the Middle East. And so I'll be doing as much as I can here on the Cross in the Desert to keep us informed. I remember about a year and a half ago, I had Juliana Tamazuski and Iraqi Christian Relief Fund. She was here on the program when we talked about the Assyrian Christians in Iraq. And so there are many ways we can help and reach out to these people. But the thing that is most distressing in this whole situation is the silence of the media about the Christian genocide. Just recently, Piers Morgan appeared with Tucker Carlson on his program on Fox News Channel and discussed how the media has been ignoring the Christian genocide. Let's listen.
Well, Egypt has the largest Christian community in the Middle East and one of the oldest in the world. It predates Islam, of course, by hundreds of years. But that community is now under siege, truly. On Sunday, at least 44 people were killed in a pair of suicide bombings targeting Palm Sunday celebrations in churches. We've got some footage of that attack, which is pretty awful. It was one of the latest of many attacks on the Egyptian minority, the Christian minority there. And yet the American press doesn't seem to care much about it, the obliteration of the Middle East's once large Christian population. The question is, why don't they care? We're joined now by Piers Morgan. He's editor-at-large at dailymail.com. Piers, thanks a lot for coming on. So you sent out a tweet right after this saying, this will not get the attention of massacres in Europe, but it should. Why won't it, do you think?
I think, unfortunately, if it happens in the Middle East, this kind of atrocity, it just does not seem to attract the kind of media attention in America that it would if it happened, as we've seen in the attacks in Sweden the last few days, in London 2 weeks ago. I was there for that. Huge attention in the American media, in Paris, in Nice, these get huge attention. And yet what happened in Egypt was unbelievably significant. If you look at what ISIS really stands for, what they are carrying out now in the Middle East and in Egypt in particular is a kind of genocidal attack on Christians and Christianity. They want Christianity eradicated. and they want to convert all Muslims to their crusade. They want it to be a holy war, and they want Christians gone. And I don't think that narrative is getting the attention it should get in the American media, and I have to say in other media as well around the world.
What's so strange is the West is primarily Christian, predominantly. I mean, that's what makes it the West. And yet there's this sense that it's somehow wrong to root for the home team. When something happens to Christians abroad, it's somehow, I don't know, impolite to mention it because it's self-interested. Have you noticed this?
Right. I mean, look, you know, ISIS couldn't be more transparent. After the attack in St. Petersburg last week, they made it absolutely clear. This is a war against the cross. They said that. That was what the statement said. They are at war in their heads with Christianity, not just with Christianity. They're at war with all other religions as well. But they have been singling out in increasingly virulent terms that their real war now is against Christians and the cross. You know, I'm a Catholic. You know, the Pope Francis is due to go to Egypt in 2 weeks' time. I'm concerned about his safety. After what happened on Palm Sunday, I'm concerned about the Pope's safety. He would be a massive target, a massive prize for these Islamist terrorists. And they've made it very clear that he is a number one target for them in their battle against Christians. You know, they attacked a church where the Coptic Pope was actually officiating. So they have made their intentions clear. Now, I think this is a huge story. This is the kind of story that ought to be dominating cable news in America. It should be dominating headlines around the world. The press in America should be full of headlines about this. This narrative, to me, is very straightforward. ISIS have declared war on Christianity. I'm not seeing that being covered enough.
No. No, basically no one is covering it here. I think you're in the UK right now. But you can just imagine the silence this has been greeted by. You know, here and there a story. Part of the problem is there are no spokesmen for this. So if almost any other group was under attack, you would have people calling up TV stations and saying, put me on, I represent this group. Where are the leaders of Christian churches in America, in the West, stand? I mean, I don't want to single anyone out by name, Archbishop of Canterbury, but like, where are they? Why aren't they saying something?
Well, I couldn't agree more with you. And they're very quick, these leaders, to come off and get on the airwaves and talk about other atrocities. You know, when a handful of people were killed in London, I was there, I worked literally 500 yards from Westminster Bridge. So I was there within hours of that happening. And I was struck by the immediate race by religious figures to come and talk about this in public. But where are they now after what happened in Egypt? Why is that not deemed to be hugely significant to them? The death toll was far higher. The number of wounded was far higher. And yet it seems to be, in the eyes of the global media and global religious leaders, not to be as important as these kind of wannabe jihadis that we're seeing,
right,
who probably spend too much time on the internet getting into trucks and mowing people down. Well, yeah, they're dangerous people, and they're hideous atrocities, and obviously our thoughts go with the people that they kill and maim and the rest of it. But actually what happened in Egypt, to me, with these attacks on these two Coptic churches, was hugely more significant in the overall war. It looked very tactical by ISIS. It looked like they sent in highly trained people to do this. And it looked a far more coordinated part of a much bigger plot by them to take on Christianity, as was the attack in St. Petersburg. They said it, like I said. They said this was an attack on the cross. But again, the coverage of St. Petersburg, the coverage in Egypt, not as high as the coverage of a handful of people being killed in Sweden and London. And I ask simply, why?
I think that's – thank you for being such a clear voice in this. Not to mention the Christians in Iraq who have basically been exterminated. Piers Morgan, editor-at-large, dailymail.com. I appreciate it.
Thanks, Tucker.
And many thanks to Tucker Carlson and Piers Morgan for this subject needs to be addressed every day. Just recently, the World Summit in Defense of Persecuted Christians was hosted by the Billy Graham Association, Franklin Graham. So there are voices out there being raised in defense of persecuted Christians. And coupled with that, with the release of this very important documentary called Faith Keepers, this is the time to educate, to get involved, for being a voice for our brothers and sisters suffering in the persecuted church in the Middle East. And as I think about them, and I think about the families whose hearts have been torn in two with the death of their loved ones, I think about the many reasons why Christians are not afraid The many reasons why Christians remain strong and defiant in the preaching of the gospel in spite of the atrocities committed by ISIS is because they love Jesus. It's because he's the hope of the world, the hope for all mankind. And this is an appropriate song I want to end with today in dedication to our brothers and sisters who are fighting the good fight of faith in the Middle East. This is a song called I Pledge Allegiance to the Lamb, Ray Bowles. Right now on the cross in the desert.
I have heard how Christians long ago were brought before a tyrant's throne, and they were told that he would spare their lives if they would renounce the name of Christ. The Son of God, they would not deny, like a great angelic choir song. I can almost hear their voice.
A very appropriate song sung by Ray Bolts, I Pledge Allegiance to the Lamb, dedicated to our courageous brothers and sisters under persecution in the Middle East. I'll be back in about 2.5 minutes and continue my special live reading of my new book, Finding Hope in a Future. See you in about 2 minutes. Thank you. welcome to a very special live reading of my newest publication, Finding Hope and a Future, Maral's Journey to Freedom, Part 4. We are in the middle of Chapter 3, A Broken Marriage. For the first few years of their marriage, Maral and Ali lived in a tiny apartment in the wealthy district of Shiraz. Money was never a problem because Ali spent most of his married life working at the plastics factory. It seemed that he was married more to his job than his newfound bride. Maral spent many lonely hours at the apartment while Ali traveled for his job. Even when Ali was finally at home, he spent most of his time on his cell phone discussing contracts for the plastics factory. From the very beginning, Maral felt like a widow. The husband that she thought she knew turned out to be someone completely different. Bored and lonely, Maral would ask Ali if he would accompany her to her parents for a visit. Each time that she asked, Ali was too busy and would make up an excuse that he couldn't go. Maral was hurt that Ali seemed to neglect not only time with her, but also her family. Teaching Kung Fu and the Persian language was the only time Maral really enjoyed herself. But soon after their marriage, Ali insisted that she stay home and take care of the house. "You don't need to teach Kung Fu, Maral. We don't need the extra money." Maral was devastated. Teaching was the passion of her life, and now her new husband had decided that it was no longer important. Ali was slowly suffocating her life. He had become controlling. Guilty feelings began to torment Maral day and night. Why hadn't she listened to her father from the very beginning? Why hadn't she seen the big picture after she met Ali's family? Ali's family was very rich and religious compared to Maral's family. They felt superior to her family because of their great wealth and spiritual heritage. Maral remembered the day she discovered that she was pregnant. Tears of joy flooded her eyes. Now she believed her marriage would soon change. Surely this would make Ali happy, and he would be more willing to spend less time at work and more time at home. Although Ali was happy with Maral's news, he confided in her a terrible secret that cut her soul into pieces. "My parents prefer if you give birth to a son rather than a daughter." Ali's words cut her like a knife. "What if I give birth to a girl?" Maral nervously pondered to herself. The terrible strain of living up to the standards of her in-laws was tearing Maral apart. Yet they didn't stop there. Ali next told Maral that his parents wanted her to attend one of the biggest holidays in Iran, the Day of Ashura. The Day of Ashura took place once a year in December. It was a very high and holy Muslim day where thousands took to the streets commemorating the death of the Prophet Muhammad's grandson, Imam Hussein. It was the death of Hussein 1,300 years ago that was a turning point leading to the split of Islam into Shia and Sunni sects. On this day, thousands would participate in mass self-flagellation ceremonies, beating their bare backs with chains and cutting themselves with swords and knives. "You must go, Maral, or else you will disrespect my family." The sight of watching men in self-flagellating ceremonies was very repulsive to Maral. She reluctantly attended the Day of Ashura and did her best to cover her eyes. She realized why she was being forced to go. They wanted her to take Islam much more seriously. As Maral watched men and women beating themselves and crying, she turned away, repulsed by what they were doing. Many other women gave her angry stares while Maral silently prayed. "Oh God, please help me tolerate this. Why are they crying for an Arab man who died over 1,000 years ago?" Maral's pregnancy had taken a turn for the worst. Her blood pressure became dangerously low, and she was vomiting more often. She couldn't keep food down and was becoming too weak to stay at home alone. In the last trimester of her pregnancy, Maral could finally breathe a sigh of relief. She had found out that the sex of the baby was male. This would be pleasing to Ali's family. Even though Maral was happy about having a child, yet she was miserable and sick most of the time. Ali had forced her to give up her teaching and all of her single friends. Her marriage had become literally a ball and chains. Ali was controlling her life, and somehow Maral needed to find a way to escape from her prison of fear. On Monday, November 7th, 2005, at 10:10 a.m. in the morning, Maral gave birth to her first child and named him Parham. Parham's name in Persian meant Abraham, angel of goodness. When Shabnam, Maral's best friend, had heard she had been taken to Hafez Hospital in Shiraz, she immediately got in the car and quickly drove to the location. Arriving within a few minutes, she identified herself and was escorted into the delivery room. "Oh, finally, my sister is a mother," Shabnam explained, holding Parham tight up against her chest. Opening up her little tiny suitcase, Shabnam removed some baby clothes and began dressing Parham in a light green-colored rabbit suit with pink ears sticking up. Shabnam was overwhelmed with joy for her dear sister. The birth of a child would be just what their difficult marriage would need for healing. Even after the birth of Parham, Maral continued to be left alone at home while Ali worked endless hours at the plastics factory. In order to give his wife some assistance, Ali agreed to hire a young 20-year-old girl named Fatima. Fatima's duties would be washing and cleaning while Maral was busy taking care of Parham. The arrangement seemed to work out perfectly until the day arrived that would change Maral's life forever. During Ali's absence, Maral spent a lot of time at her parents' home. They loved to hold Parham and experience the role of being grandparents for the first time in their lives. Today, Maral wanted to spend a little more time with her parents and decided to call Ali at work to ask for permission. When Ali answered the phone, Maral was having trouble hearing his voice because of the sound of a loud TV playing in the background. That was very unusual to hear a TV, Maral thought to herself, since there wasn't a TV at Ali's workplace. Immediately, Maral became suspicious and decided to drive home. Pulling into the driveway, she was surprised to find Ali's car already there. It had been only a matter of minutes since she had spoken with him on the phone. Quickly opening the front door, Maral was shocked to see Fatima inside. She could hear the sound of the shower running. "Why are you here, Fatima?" Maral nervously asked. Fatima turned off the TV. She had a calm and relaxed expression on her face. "I thought you needed me, so I waited here for you." Maral didn't accept Fatima's explanation. She instantly became enraged. "I never called you. Don't lie to me." Disgusted, Maral walked swiftly toward the bathroom and pounded on the door. "You said you were at work," Maral shouted as she waited patiently outside of the bathroom door. After a few minutes, Ali finally emerged, wiping his hair with a towel and dressed in a pair of shorts. He looked intently into Maral's eyes with an innocent expression on his face. "What's wrong? Why are you shouting? I just got home," Ali calmly explained. Ali looked toward the living room and stared at Fatima, who was standing in the front of the TV. She was visibly upset. Ali took an angry deep breath and continued drying himself off. "You know that every time I come home from work that I take a shower." "Pay her and tell her to leave," Maral insisted, ignoring Ali's explanation. Convinced that her husband was lying to cover up an affair, that night Maral refused to sleep in the same bed with Ali and instead stayed in Parham's room. It was the same night that she also lost all love and respect for Ali. Maral could no longer trust Ali. He was not the same man she knew after their first date. He was a totally different person, and she hated herself for not seeing it before they got married. She remembered the story her father shared with her that one day she would return home bringing the salt of sadness with her. Feelings of guilt tormented Maral's mind. her father's story was coming true. A few weeks later, Maral had to make a special trip to the plastics factory after having car problems. Walking toward the front door, she suddenly spotted Fatima on her way into Ali's office. Maral cautiously waited and then followed Fatima into the office, making sure she was not noticed. "What are you doing here?" Maral demanded. Fatima spun around, surprised to see Maral. "I'm working here," Fatima replied. Ali walked into the room as Fatima finished explaining to Maral. "What's wrong? What are you doing here?" Ali asked with an angry look on his face. "I had car problems." "What is she doing here?" Maral demanded, pointed her finger toward Fatima. "Fatima needed the money, so I hired her." "Why do you ask? That's none of your business," Ali angrily protested. Maral had heard enough. She turned and stormed out of the front door. A few days later, stopped at a traffic light, Maral spotted Ali's car. After the light changed, she sped up and was now just a few feet away from the passenger windows. Inside of the car was Fatima. Maral could feel a rush of anger tearing at her soul. She watched them talking and laughing together. For Maral, this was the end of the road for her. Arriving home first, Maral waited at the front door for Ali. Her heart was racing in her chest. After a few minutes, the front door opened and Ali walked inside. "I saw you and Fatima together in the car," Maral screamed in anger. "Which one of us is going to leave this house?" Ali chuckled, giving Maral an arrogant stare as he hung up his jacket. "Leave this house? I own this house, Maral. You can go, and I will take care of Parham." Maral pushed herself up against Ali, staring at him face to face. "You must go," Maral screamed. Ali shoved the palm of his hand up against Maral's forehead in a fit of anger. Maral was shocked and stumbled backwards, struggling to keep her balance. "You cannot tell me what to do," Ali shouted back with a fierce look in his eyes. "I own this apartment, and Parham is my child." Maral's first reaction as an accomplished student of Kung Fu should have been to strike back in defense, but instead, she cowered in fear. She was speechless. Unable to cope with Ali's violent temper, Maral retreated to staying in Parham's room, refusing to speak to Ali. While he was at work, she cooked the evening meal but left it on the stove for him when he arrived home. Fear and depression had captivated Maral's heart and mind. She could barely eat anything and spent all of her time doing her best to take care of Parham. Unable to cope with the prison she had made for herself, she began removing the pictures from the walls of their apartment and storing them in boxes. The apartment had become a prison, a house of sadness. After a hard day of work, when Ali returned home, he was stunned by what he saw. The walls of the apartment were bare. His home looked empty. Taking an angry deep breath, he ran through the house looking for Maral and suddenly spotted her cell phone lying on the bed. He picked it up and noticed a text message on the screen from Shabnam telling Maral to divorce him. Ali threw her cell phone down on the floor. It shattered in pieces. Maral finally emerged from the bathroom and saw Ali standing over the pieces of her cell phone. "Why did you do that?" Maral screamed in anger. "So the black girl is giving you a plan," Ali screamed back, referring to Shabnam's message. "She's my sister," Maral replied, pushing Ali out of the way to pick up the pieces of her phone. Ali grabbed Maral's arm and pulled her towards him. Maral resisted and tried to break his grip, but Ali squeezed her arm tighter. "This black girl is not my aunt's son, not my son's aunt." Maral wanted to defend herself and fight back, but was once again paralyzed with fear. In order to punish Maral, Ali removed the furniture out of their apartment into a temporary dwelling place at the factory. He then decided to put their apartment up for rent. Reluctantly, Maral followed Ali to their new living place at the factory, afraid that she would lose custody of Parham. It was at the factory that Ali turned into an abusive monster. He began physically abusing Maral when she complained or protested about their living conditions. On one occasion, he punched Maral in the eye, even though she begged him to stop. Horrified by what she saw in the mirror, Maral called her brother Muhammad, desperate to escape the prison of hell that she had found herself in. When Muhammad saw Maral's black and blue eyes, he demanded an explanation. At first, she was too afraid to admit to what happened and made it up an excuse that she had just simply fallen in the bathroom. Muhammad refused to believe her story. He was shaking in fear and anger. Picking up his mobile, Muhammad called Farshad and told him what had happened. Immediately, Farshad drove to the factory and confronted Ali. Coming out of the shower, Maral toweled off and dressed. Hearing police sirens and commotions outside, she quickly ran to the balcony and saw Ali being handcuffed by the police. He was bleeding from the head. She also saw both of her brothers being escorted away. Maral realized that there was only one way to escape her life of hell, but it would be very difficult to accomplish. Women in Iran have little or no chance of divorcing their husbands. In almost every case, the man is awarded custody of the children by the judge. Maral's only chance would be to try and convince Ali that getting a divorce would be financially advantageous for him. After consulting with her family, Maral decided that a divorce is her only hope of survival. However, unless Ali agreed to it, she would be powerless to do anything. Women in Iran are both the victims and possessions of men. The law is always on their side because of their man-centered commitment to the tenets of Sharia law. In the marriage arrangement, the husband must pay the wife a financial dowry settlement in the case of a divorce. Maral explained to the judge that she would cancel this obligation so that Ali would not be liable to pay. "Judge, I don't want a dowry payment. All I want is a divorce." Maral met privately with Ali to discuss the terms of the divorce. "If you don't give me a divorce, then you will have to pay the 5 million tomans to me," Maral warned Ali. Ali reluctantly agreed to the bargain on the condition that Maral would consider coming back to him in a few years. Fearing that she could lose the custody of her child, Maral nervously agreed. For the next few months, Maral was able to have custody of Parham while the detail and arrangements of the divorce were worked out in court. During that time, she lived with parents and went to dancing class to relieve the stress and depression that she was suffering with every day. It was difficult during this time in Maral's life that we met on Facebook. Maral excitedly sent me a friend request when she saw the picture of political prisoners on my page. She was so impressed that an American man was standing up and speaking out for her people. Within a few days, Maral and I had become very close friends. I sent her a copy of my book, The Rose of Nowruz, and met with her on Skype to help her with English. I had no idea drastically Maral's life was going to change within just a few days. It would be the beginning of an incredible and dangerous struggle for her survival. And thus, today ends the reading of Chapter 3 in my book, Finding Hope and a Future, Maral's Journey to Freedom. I hope you're enjoying this read. My whole purpose of reading my book is to bring awareness to the plight of Iranian women. This is the reason I do my program, The Cross in the Desert. I speak out for the human rights of everyone, but particularly women. And as you can see in this particular case, how Ali masqueraded who he really was until they were married. Women really are the possessions of men in an Islamic culture. You know, the Quran very clearly teaches in Surah chapter 4, verse 35, that if a husband suspects that his wife is unfaithful, he will admonish her, confront her, refuse to sleep with her, and then the Quran says he can have the right to beat her. This is what the Quran teaches men to do to women. It is not a book of equal partnership. It is a book of violence against women. And so as I read you my newest book, I just want to make you aware that you can go up to Amazon.com. It's in both paperback and Kindle. And when you purchase a copy of this book, most of the proceeds will go towards delivering Bibles to Iranians through Alam Ministries. And this is my dedication that Iranians find their hope and freedom in Jesus through reading God's Word, the Bible. And so part of the proceeds to any sale of my books will go toward Alam Ministries. Bibles can be made available, but they have to be smuggled in to Iranians who are thirsty, who are hungry, truth, in an environment where religion is used to berate them, to control them, and eventually destroy them. I will keep you updated on the results of the Iranian election, and just keep a watch on my Facebook page. Please pray for my friend Jacqueline Sultan, whose life is in danger in Pakistan. It has been a pleasure once again to come to you on my program, The Cross in the Desert. I hope that you have a great weekend. God bless you. I will see you soon again on The Cross in the Desert, live on Monday, 9:30 a.m. Central Standard Time. God bless you, and have an incredible weekend, and I will see you on Monday.